The next case to be heard is 2013-1544, Columbus Board of Education versus Franklin County Board of Revision. Appearing for the appellant, well, we'll wait just a second here. Appearing for the appellant, which is the property owner, Ms. Klima or Klima?
Klima.
Klima, Ms. Klima. I apologize. Please present your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm Connie Klima, and I represent the appellant. There are two matters that I wish to address today. The first being appellee has filed a motion to dismiss, which has not been ruled upon by the court. And then, of course, the briefs of the case, the merits of the case. I'll begin with the dismissal or the motion for dismissal. Pelley filed a motion for dismissal basing that motion on a jurisdictional argument, basically taken off of relying on Olympic Steel v. Cuyahoga County Board of Revision, saying that the failure to name the tax commissioner as a Pelley in the notice of appeal and failure to serve notice on the tax commissioner by certified mail requires this appeal to be dismissed. We disagree. I do understand and have read plenty of the cases in this regard issued by the Supreme Court. In Olympic Steel, the court had found that under 5717.04, there is a requirement that an appellate who wishes to challenge the BTA's decision must serve the tax commissioner, who by statute must be made an appellee, with a copy of the notice of appeal by certified mail. When I filed the notice of appeal, the tax commissioner was not made an appellee and was not served notice by certified mail. However, I must make note of fact that the tax commissioner did not appear before the BTA and was not a party before the BOR. According to Revised Code 2505.04, an appeal is perfected when a notice of appeal is filed, which was done. No step to be taken subsequent to the perfection of appeal is jurisdictional.
But even so, you subsequently, as I recall, did effect service before the briefing started in this case?
Yes, Your Honor. Upon receiving notice of the motion to dismiss, certified mail and a copy of the notice of appeal was delivered to the tax commissioner prior to any other filings before the court. The tax commissioner was not only served, but as we also know in St. Bernard Self-Storage v. Hamilton County Board of Review, failure to name the tax commissioner as an appellee does not deprive the court of jurisdiction if the tax commissioner has been served, and the tax commissioner was served. This court's rules state under Supreme Court Practice Rule 3.11D2, if the Supreme Court determines service was not made as required and the interests of justice warrant, the Supreme Court may order the document be served and impose a new deadline for filing any responsive document. Our request is that the court would do that, of course, but we did that prior to the court requesting it. Justice Pfeiffer dissented in Olympic Steel, stating that while 5717.04 requires a party that appeal a decision of Board of Tax Appeals to this court to serve notice of the appeal on the tax commissioner, dual requirements such as this should not be a part of our rules. They serve no purpose except to deny parties a chance to be heard on the merits. And later in Justice French and her dissent of Village of Hills and Dales in Ohio Department of Education, based her dissent on the common sense conclusion that as long as the notice of appeal meets the minimum statutory requirements for perfecting the appeal, which this one did, other defects in the notice could and should be corrected by amendments. I request that the court consider our motion to deny the dismissal. If I may, Your Honor, I'll move on now to the brief. This case to me is a very simple story. In 2008, my client had constructed an additional unit to a three-unit apartment building, had combined the parcels, and had substantially completed the property garages substantially completed.
What the combination of parcels?
Yes.
So there was a combination here, and when did that occur?
That had occurred, I believe, in 2007.
Okay. So that was before the first of these 2 years that are discussed in the briefs.
In 2007, construction was initiated and the parcels were combined so that the fourth unit could be attached to this three-unit building and be one parcel. And the reason for the combination was because of that construction. In 2008, as of January 1st, 2008, the majority of the construction had been completed, and my client was beginning to solicit renters for that property. The auditor had, in 2008, the first year of the triennium, had raised the value of the property to $529,000. My client asked me to file a complaint with the Board of Revision. We had not had an appraisal done after construction was completed, so we brought an appraiser in, and they appraised the property as constructed at $350,000. The Board of Education filed a counter-complaint. And at the 2008 hearing, which was in 2009, the Board of Revision determined that the property was valued at $350,000, which we had requested and which our appraisal confirmed. The Board of Education did not appeal that determination. Less than approximately a month later, my client called me, very concerned, because he received notice from the auditor that for the 2009 year, the property would be raised to a value of $970,000, showing that its value in 2008 was $529,000. I said, well, that is a mistake. Obviously, the auditor does not know that the value was not considered to be $529,000 in 2008. It was now considered by the Board of Revision to be $350,000. I contacted the auditor's office. I talked to the Board of Revision, and they said, obviously, notices had passed in the mail, and see what I could do. Finally, after about a month or two of talking to many people, they advised me the only and best thing to do was to file a new complaint for the 2009 tax year and explain what I considered to be the mistake. We went back before the Board of Revision for the 2009. Board of Education filed its counter-complaint and stating that the value should be $970,000, which would now be a raise between $350,000 to $970,000 for an addition of one unit. At that hearing, I resubmitted again the cost that I had submitted at the 2008 hearing, the cost of construction, the same appraisal, and claimed that a collateral estoppel argument did exist because the Board of Education was challenging what had already been challenged in 2008, and that was the value of this property, as we said, constructed. We presented that argument, and at the end, the Board of...
Let me ask you a question about the 2008 year.
Yes.
Before us today is 2009.
Yes.
But with respect to the 2008 year, was the finding it was a value of what, $350,000?
Yes.
Was that finding based in part on the notion that there was construction that was not yet complete?
The Board of Education said that the construction had been not completed in 2008, and therefore the auditor had the right or the right to come back and reevaluate for new construction in 2009, and therefore it should be considered by the Board of Revision. The Board of Revision, however, said with their response, their determination was it was still valued at $350,000. That was their determination. My argument before the Board of Revision was, here are the same costs. We have little left to show for 2009. The units are now rented, and we believe it's valued at $350,000, which is what you found it to be in 2008 when construction was substantially completed. So again, the Board of Revision said it should be valued at $350,000 and not $970,000. The Board of Education then filed an appeal to the Board of Tax Appeals. And we both waived oral arguments and submitted briefs. Again, my brief reiterated my claim to a collateral estoppel argument, stating that if the Board of Education had challenged the value of construction, they should have done that in 2008, not 2009, when it was presented. And I also then made the argument, as I do today before the court, that if, in fact, the Board of Revision was considering new construction in 2008, then it should have changed or could have raised the value at the 2009 hearing, but it didn't. It again agreed that it was valued at $350,000. So there was consideration the second time. Obviously, it was made by the Board of Revision at the 2009 hearing. Case law in Ohio, most recent case law, basically says that the burden would be on the Board of Education to show why this property would have increased from $350,000 to $970,000.
Well, but your client filed the complaint for 09, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. And we did, again, provide the reasoning, the values that we had in this property and an appraisal. But the Board of Education, when it filed its motion to appeal, provided no evidence to support it or the auditor's 2009 valuation of the Ferris property at the 2009 hearing, and the Board of Education's brief provided no evidence to support it or the auditor's valuation to the Board of Tax Appeals. The decision by the court actually states that while the Board of Education has appealed this to the Board of Tax Appeals, it has provided no evidence of supporting the value of $970,000. I want to say the only in my brief obviously discusses all of these things, but I want to make these points to the court today. The Board of Education provided no evidence to support a valuation of $970,000 of this property, but it did try to point out flaws in the arguments that I presented, which obviously is a good way to proceed if you have no evidence. One of the things they continually stated, and I continually correct, is that they considered these as condos. They refer to these as condominiums. These are not condominiums. This is a four-unit apartment building. We had contemplated at one time converting them, and my client did not. As we know, an auditor will value condominium units differently than a four-unit apartment building. It's also interesting that I provided, or the record provides, and we point out that at the 2009 hearing, a member of the Board of Revision has written that as of 1/1/08, construction was completed. He then adds to his notes that the units were now in 2009 had been rented, etc. The Board of Education states in their brief that there was a scrivener's error made by, obviously, a scrivener's error had been made by the Board of Revision member. Interesting enough, they have determined that was a scrivener's error, and yet in their own field notes that they rely upon, they state that another Board of Revision member had written, or I'm sorry, that the auditor's record shows that the property was 60% complete when the office auditor performed its field inspection in 2008. What they don't state is that the field notes that they're relying on do not say that it was 60% completed in 2008. They state that it was 60% completed in December 2007. Now, one could say, well, that's only a month away from January 1st, 2008. But why is that argument any better than our argument that an appraisal done in early 2008 is less reliable because it was not done on January 1st, 2008? I want to point that fact out.
Let me ask you a couple of questions.
Yes.
To make sure that I've got your argument. You're saying that the school board should have shouldered the burden of producing more evidence at the Board of Tax Appeals for tax year 2009.
Yes.
And the reason, or one reason for that is that the Board of Revision adopted the lower value, the $350,000 for '09, or did they?
The Board of Revision adopted the $350,000 value.
For '09 as well as '08?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
My point is that in 2009, even if they had goofed in 2008, the Board of Revision, they again had it before them because I had to file a new complaint based on what I believe was a mistake made by the auditor. Again, they were presented with the costs of construction, and the Board of Education was there and could have challenged the cost, but did not. And when they appealed it, the Board of Education then appealed again, the same valuation given by the Board of Revision at $350,000. It did not provide any evidence to the Board of Tax Appeals. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kalima. Mr. Gillis.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Mark Gillis on behalf of the Board of Education of the Columbus City School District. I'm going to go backwards here. I'm going to go on the merits first and then visit the jurisdictional issue. It's important to note with regard to burdens of proof before the BTA. First of all, the BTA is required to do a de novo review of the evidence and is required to independently determine the value of the property. I think that the argument indicating that the Board of Education was required to produce evidence is overstated in this case. It stems from a recent decision from this court, collectively known as East Bank 1. However, in that case, the court ruled that the property owner in that matter had affirmatively negated the auditor's value. Their evidence in that case demonstrated that the property was partially constructed as of tax lien date, and there was no information in the record to indicate that the auditor had valued it as such. In this case, we're talking about tax year 2009. Nobody disagrees that this property is 100% complete. Nobody has challenged the way the auditor valued the property. Therefore, East Bank doesn't apply here because the auditor's value has not been affirmatively negated. And one might say, we presented an appraisal. Well, that appraisal is hearsay. It was properly objected to. The appraiser wasn't presented to testify and explain his valuation and what he did and how his opinions were derived. So therefore, we submit that the court's decision in Vandalia Butler, commonly called Timberlake, still applies, which means that the Board of Education can meet its burden at the BTA through cross-examination and post-hearing brief, which it did in this matter. Moving.
Well, when you say cross-examination, the appraiser didn't testify, right?
The appraiser didn't testify, but the property owner did. And so there was testimony with regard to the percentage of completion done or the amount of when the construction was done. The statements being made today clearly admit that the property was not completed as of 1/1/2008. Statement made to you just a minute ago was the majority of construction was done. The auditor's record card seems to indicate that they consider it to be 60% or a majority of that construction. There was no detailed information as to how much was done. There was more than just the building of the fourth unit. They spent a total of $304,000 building the fourth unit, but also rehabbing the other three. There's a substantial difference between the value of property in need of rehab, which may or may not be inhabitable, and the final constructed inhabitable properties. That's why the auditor was required under 5713.01 to revalue the property. And when they revalue the property, they don't just simply slap the construction cost onto the prior value because the property has substantially changed. They're required to do a reappraisal. Getting to the auditor's notice, the auditor's value in this case for 2008 was $529. It was and always has been. The Board of Revision issued a decision rightly or wrongly, it was unappealed, at 350. But the auditor's certified value listed on his 08 tax list and duplicate was $529,000. The mentioning of that in the notice to the property owner, quite frankly, is irrelevant. The notification is sent to the property owner informing him of the new value of the property and informing him of the right to file a complaint, because they had filed one in 08. Without that notice and value change, they would not have been entitled to file the second complaint. Statutorily, the auditor is required to provide the notice. It's only the notice of the new value. Moving back to the jurisdictional issue.
So, that is something that leaps out about this case, that there's a complaint filed for the second year of the triennium when there was also a complaint filed for the first year.
Mm-hmm.
And the complaint here marks substantial improvement or whatever as the exception that applies to the rule against the second filed complaint. And your position is that this complaint was jurisdictionally proper because of what the auditor had done?
We have no problem with the original complaint being jurisdictionally valid,
right.
And that is because, for two reasons. One, the auditor changed the value, and so there was no complaint against the same value from the prior year. But more importantly, it was the reason. There was a substantial improvement made to the property after January 1st of 2008, but before January 1st of 2009. So therefore, the decision of the Board of Revision in 2008, the notes of one member, and we're not even quite sure which one, are not a part of the BOR's decision. They are not findings of fact. They can in no way collaterally stop any party from challenging that notation. We're not even sure what it means. It may have simply been a notation of what counsel or the property owner said at the hearing. It's not listed in their decision, so it's not a part of their decision. Moving back to the jurisdictional issue, appellant has admitted they didn't comply with the statute. They claim that 250504 resolves them of that requirement. However, if we read 250503B, it says, unless other sections of the revised code apply, such appeal is governed by this chapter. We have another section that applies. It's 57-1704. Furthermore, we have a Supreme Court rule. It's now 1001A2, which is former rule 23A1. And this goes directly to Justice Pfeiffer's dissent in Olympic Steel. The statement with regard to this requirement really isn't a dissent, but more of a disagreement with the actual rule. Justice Pfeiffer stated, Supreme Court practice rule 23A1 requires performance or conformance with revised code 57-1704, which requires parties that appeal a decision of the Board of Tax Appeals to this court to serve a notice of appeal on the tax commissioner. He doesn't like that rule, but he admits that the rule requires compliance. In this court's decision in Berea, it stated that that rule requires compliance, service on the tax commissioner within the 30-day period.
The two things. One is, it is true, isn't it, that that the property owner did effectuate service, albeit after the appeal period was over.
That's correct.
And that occurred before the briefing started in this case.
It did, and the only reason it happened is because I filed a motion to dismiss. Mm-hmm. So a ruling that upholds Berea but allows it in this case says that as the opposing party, I shouldn't bring it to the court's attention until I stand here before you today. I don't think that's how the court wants us to operate. We are supposed to bring jurisdictional issues to the court as soon as we notice them, and then they can't be cured solely because they were brought to their attention. Furthermore, Berea said it's jurisdictional, and service must be initiated, which they specifically stated is placed in the mail within the 30-day appeal period.
You're right that Berea says that, but does the statute itself, 5717.04, does not itself explicitly state that that has to occur within the appeal period? You'd agree with that?
I would agree with that. There is no specific time frame in 04. However, the Supreme Court practice rule is entitled perfection of an appeal. Mm-hmm. And so in order to perfect the appeal under the Supreme Court's rules, you have to comply with 04, which requires service on the tax commissioner. So if you don't serve the tax commissioner within the appeal period, under the Supreme Court's own rules, you haven't perfected your appeal. You can't perfect your appeal after the appeal period. I have nothing further.
Thank you, Mr. Gillis. Ms. Klima, you've reserved 7 seconds, but you may take a minute for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. In regard to the motion to dismiss, Mr. Gillis has stated that the only reason we actually served notice by certified mail prior to any briefings to the tax commissioner is because of his motion to dismiss. That is correct. It brought me, made me aware of it. And I would hope that the statutes and the court would be of the mind that it's not about what attorney is best at the rules, but what is done to make the case heard by the parties that should be heard, hearing it, and participating. So the good is done by the fact that notice is sent, whether it's in good or bad spirit. I'd also like to state that if, in fact, the auditor and the Board of Education believed that the property in December of 2007 was 60% completed, and if the property was valued, as the Board of Education had determined, $350,000, then the valuation of the property for 2008 would be in the mid 500,000s, not 970,000, which brings me back to what I believe would be a mistake, because if the auditor believed the property was 60% completed at the end of 2007, he raised it probably 40% from the $529,000 value and not the $350,000 value. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Klima. This case will be submitted, and the court will advise the parties of its decision.